This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, sports fans, it's Mason Crosby.
And Reese Crosby.
If you enjoy football, football,
be sure to check out Kicking It with the Crosbys. New episodes drop every Tuesday and Thursday.
Subscribe on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Beltway blitzing in-house today on Grant and Danny here on The Fan. Nats lefty Shinosuke Ogasawara got a preview of Major League Baseball hitters on Monday. This was yesterday, throwing to live hitters for the first time in spring training. My expectations for him are low. There wasn't a big market to acquire him, which I think is somewhat telling. He's a lefty. He doesn't throw that hard. But I do think it is a huge deal that the Nats finally signed a player from
100%,
Japan.
100%.
This has to be a story. They have just neglected this. They have kind of refused to engage in the market, and they finally did. This gives me hope. Not that they'll actually spend any real money, but that maybe it's another avenue to get some players like Ogasawara moving forward.
Absolutely. And that's to me more significant than the actual player himself. Because, you know, I think maybe he starts in AAA to stretch out a little bit, kind of get used to paying or pitching every fifth day. Maybe he's a swing guy in the bullpen and they work him along that way. It's, you know, it's an adjustment because those guys, I think in the Japanese, like, I think they throw every 6 or 7 days. This is obviously a different schedule here with Major League Baseball. So he's not a as high a profile guy as some of the dudes that are fetching these $100 million posting fees and the like. The significance is more that they actually dip their toe into that marketplace for the first time.
And possibly he'll help them.
You know, right.
Whether it's out of the bullpen, supposedly they told me it was going to be in the rotation. This is one of those things where like 15 people are showing up for a party where only 5 can stay with a ticket where they all say, they told me I was invited to the party because they told pretty much all 3 of their veteran additions that are arms. Trevor Williams, he was going to be back in the rotation. Mike Soroka, apparently Ogasawara as well. And that means that a couple of your kids might not make the rotation, which I hope isn't the case. But I'll slot him in the bullpen, see if he can kind of find his way as a long reliever. Also over the weekend, the Nationals made a move. Paul DeJong, who hit 24 home runs last year, infielder, no longer really an everyday player, but a guy who played on multiple teams last season. I think he's been on 5 teams in the last 2 or 3 years.
Feels that
now.
Way. Like, fill-in-the-blank team has signed Paul DeJong right around this time.
1 year, $1 million, so it tells you not a huge market for him. But they had 0 players with more than 20 home runs on their team last year.
Yeah.
He hit 24, so he's got a little bit of pop off the bench. I bet you he starts more games at third than we want him to.
That's a great way to put it. We're going to see more Paul DeJong than we signed up for.
He's going to spell C.J. Abrams at short, where he's pretty good defensively. He's probably going to play some second base for Luis Garcia. But I'll bet you he is, maybe he's not splitting time, but I'll bet you he's playing a couple of days a week at third base right away.
Yeah, he was a 30-homer bat in 2019, but, you know, I think that's those days are long gone. But you touched on it. 24 bombs across a couple of teams getting at-bats every day. He can do that for a second-division club, right? And I think you may see that.
Josiah Gray threw 60 feet in his Tommy John surgery rehab, which is one of those mile markers that you need. I mean, if he throws this season, it'll be at the very end of the year, just ramping it back up. Going to be a lost season for him on the field. But former All-Star, important player in the organization, rehab seeming
good
to go
too.
Pretty well. And, yeah, a guy that we root for because he's been a great guest of ours over the years. But at least good to hear that the early part of his rehab is on track and going pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you dread the most are the setbacks in this kind of deal, right? As long as you're adding, as long as you're doing a little bit more each time, there's no rush, kind of as you said, it's not like you're sprinting back for a playoff push or something to that effect, just the timing of it is unfortunate. It's a lost season either way. The thing that you dread the most is that sort of, hey, he felt a bit of discomfort when he expanded to throwing from 100 feet or whatever, and now you kind of restart that clock, and then they kind of go into the ether.
Nats open up their spring training schedule on Saturday against the Astros. Opening day will be here before we know it, and that for the Nats will come on Thursday, March 27th at home against Philadelphia. Joining us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, is Bobby Blanco. Bobby's been covering the team for a while now. He is an insider for Masson. You can follow Bobby on X on Twitter, at Bobby_Blanco. Let me just start with kind of big picture. Do they have any chance to be significantly improved from last year in that they would be in a wild card race in September?
Ooh. Tough hitter right off the bat. I think that, you know, looking at this roster as we head into a new season, looking back at last year, I think 71 wins. I know we talked a lot about the end of the season. Like, yes, it was the same amount of wins that they had in 2023, but there was a lot of improvement in terms of James Wood coming up, Dylan Cruz, Jake Irvin took a big leap, Mitchell Parker and DJ Hers were revelations. But they ended up with the same amount of wins as the year before. Now you're looking at this year going into a season where Wood and Cruz figure to be everyday players. All those pitchers that I just mentioned have another year under their belt, and they look to improve upon a solid staff. They actually have some pretty decent starting rotation depth right now. And then you've added pieces that fit this roster maybe a little bit better than they have in the terms of the pieces they've added in the past couple of off seasons. Nathaniel Lowe at first base, bringing Josh Bell back to be a full-time DH and not really play first base as much. Paul DeJong just recently signed. Looks like he's going to play a lot at third base. He is an all-star gold glove caliber defender in the infield. You know, you bring in Michael Soroka to add depth to that rotation. I think there's reasonable hope to go ahead and look at this season and say, I think they can win more than 71 games, but making a significant push toward the playoffs in September might be tough. I would think that ideally you're still kind of hovering around that conversation by August. And maybe you know, if things go your right, I mean, obviously everyone needs to stay healthy. You know, all those names I just mentioned, both the veterans that you brought in and the young guys that are, you know, part of your core moving forward, need to take another step forward. This team needs to hit for more power. The bullpen needs to find a closer. But, you know, if all those pieces come together by the end of camp, we could be pretty optimistic heading an opening day and being like, I'm not sure the goal should be postseason this year, but they could definitely be maybe in the conversation by the second half.
So, was there an opportunity in this offseason, had they been aggressive and been willing to spend, was there an opportunity to get someone or maybe two pieces by being aggressive that could have made your answer immediately yes?
Sure. I think if you look at maybe an Alex Bregman, maybe a Pete Alonso, I think, obviously, Juan Soto would have been another story, but the amount that he ended up getting from the Mets, I just think that's unrealistic and, you know, maybe even hinders a team. That's any team other than the Mets, Dodgers, or Yankees.
Right.
So they were able to spread out their funds a little bit more. And if they were able to go after one of those guys like an Alonso or Bregman, maybe. But, you know, we've heard Mike Rizzo speak to the media down in West Palm, you know, saying that they just really didn't think any one of those guys was enough to put this young team over the top in that instance. I don't think, I mean, baseball is a tough sport. It's not like, you know, we just watched the Commanders plug and play Jaden Daniels and all of a sudden they're in the NFC Championship game. You can't really do that in baseball because, you know, Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman don't pitch. And then you can't also just bring in a Corbin Burns and he doesn't hit and stuff like that. So you really need all 26 plus, you know, the guys that you bring up to fill in for people who are hurt. So pretty much the whole 40-man roster to be really solid top to bottom to be a really overall good team and make a push for the playoffs. So I don't know if just those one of those guys is enough to give them that extra probably 10 wins that they would need to be in that conversation or to be in the lock to be in the postseason. But it certainly wouldn't have hurt. It would definitely help their chances. But I also can kind of understand the thinking of, you know, one guy doesn't do it for us quite yet. Let's let these young guys carry us this year. You know, maybe they're good enough to, like I said earlier, put us in the conversation late in the season, and then the following off season will be the right time to strike for a big signing free agent or two or three, whatever it may be.
All right, let's talk pitching. Is Mackenzie Gore, like, is he ready to step up? I know he is their ace, but is he, I mean, would you consider, like, a year this year to be a potential breakout year for him in terms of really solidifying himself as one of the best left-handed starters in the game or not?
Yeah, I think this year can be that year for them. I mean, you look back at his season last year, I know it was two really high peaks and one really low valley in the middle of the year. You know, he was pretty solid throughout the first 2 months of the year. He's one of the best pitchers actually in the National League,
right?
And ERA under 3 by Memorial Day. High strikeout numbers as well, was winning games for them. But then he, you know, kind of hit that really big lull between like June and July, and then finally picked it back up in August and September. So it's all about consistency for him. We've seen him when he can put together not just one, but a stretch of 2 or 3, 4 starts in a row where he looks completely in control, dominant, no one can touch his stuff. He has that potential. But then we've also seen stretches of 2, 3, 4, 5 starts in a row where he's wild and he can't find the strike zone there, and guys are just teeing off on him. He's being too predictable with his pitches. So I think, yes, this year, you know, if he can put it all together and just be more consistent, he's not going to be perfect. You know, he's not going to go out, start 32 games and, you know, be perfect every single time. He's going to have some tough outings like every other starting pitcher, but limit those opportunities, you know, limit it to 1 or 2 in a row, not let it spiral into a bad month. If he can limit those, I think he can be not just the ace of this staff, but yes, one of the better starting pitchers in this league. And definitely help this Nationals team, you know, end this rotation, which they have a lot of young guys that they're hopeful for moving forward, and be the kind of leader of that young crew and be maybe, you know, all-star caliber starter for them.
So Bobby and Bobby Blanco from Masson joining us, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. So walk me through the starting rotation and then tell me where Cade Cavalli is right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I mentioned earlier, I think the rotation sneakily is one of those spots on this roster that has the most depth right now. I think your locks for the opening day rotation, assuming everyone's healthy, is Mackenzie Gore. Looks like he's, the opening day assignment might be his to lose at this point. There's no more Patrick Corbin. There's no Steven Strasburg. Josiah Gray is out for this pretty much, you know, at least for the first half of the season, if not the whole season with injury. So Mackenzie Gore lines up to be your number one starter, followed by Jake Irvin. I think those are your first two locks in this rotation. I mentioned they went out and signed Michael Soroka, who was a former all-star with the Braves. If he can find what he had in his rookie year with the Braves, where he was an all-star runner-up for rookie of the year, and kind of put the injuries that put him out for a couple of seasons behind him, they signed him to $9 million for this year. I don't think you give that guy that kind of money in relative terms to what else you're spending to not be a starter. So I think he slots in nicely as your number three starter. You brought back Trevor Williams on a 2-year deal to be a starter. So he'll probably slot back into the number four hole. Can he recapture what he had at the beginning of last year before he got hurt, where he was one of their most consistent starters over the first month and a half, maybe 2 months of the season? And then the five spot is kind of up for grabs right now. I mean, I talked about DJ Hirsch was excellent at the end of his rookie year last year. Mitchell Parker also shined at times, although lacked a little bit of consistency at times as well. And then I'm going to butcher this, but Shinosuke Ogasawara, who from their first signing ever from Japan, their first ever free agent signed from Asia, was also brought over to be a starter, another 2-year deal. Now, all three of those last guys can be optioned back down to the minors. So it is going to be kind of a competition between the three of them for that fifth spot. And whoever ends up with it, great. Those next two guys will be in line down at AAA waiting for their opportunity to come up, which will come up eventually sometime this season. And then Cade Cavalli, I mean, he's down there in West Palm. They've said he is fully healthy. The thing is that they're going to slow pace. This guy hasn't really pitched in 2 years.
Right.
You know, he had a couple of rehab outings last year. It looked like he was on pace to get back, and then they basically had to shut him down for the whole second half. So they're going to be extra cautious. It seems like he's all systems go in terms of health, but they need to be very careful with his innings limit. So whenever he starts his season, which will probably be mid to, May, June, whenever he starts the season, they want him to finish the season. So they're not really looking to push him, rush him back, at least to the major league level. But they are looking forward to getting him back on a mound and just have him get his innings back. Because, again, he has not pitched in 2 years dealing with that Tommy John. So it's all about building up his innings, his arm strength. And when he finally gets back on a mound, having him finish the season on a mound, that's most important for Cade Cavalli this year.
We're talking to Bobby Blanco from Masson. So, you know, the bullpen last year, which featured, by the way, Kyle Finnegan, who made his first All-Star game, he's no longer here. Hunter Harvey's not here. What does the bullpen look like? Who's coming out and in mid-relief, late relief, and then closing?
Yeah, this is probably the biggest maybe question or concern maybe fans would have coming into spring now, because you're right. They let Kyle Finnegan walk. They non-tendered him back in November. They were not going to give him the $8 to $9 million he was projected to earn in arbitration. So that opened up a spot in their closing spot on the roster. They brought in Jorge Lopez, who had some closing experience with the Orioles, but he hasn't really done that for the majority of his career. He's been mostly a setup man. And then they recently signed a lefty, Colin Poche, and then yesterday actually officially brought in a right-hander, Lucas Sims. Both guys have track records of being pretty decent, but setup guys. No one really has clear closing experience outside of Lopez for that 1 year in Baltimore before he was traded to the Twins. Derek Law, we know that Davey trusts him in high leverage, late inning situations. But again, last year that was mostly in like the eighth inning. And then, you know, young guys like Jose A. Ferrer have electric stuff, but not a lot of experience in the major league. Not just closing, but period in the major league. So they need him to kind of get more acclimated to pitching in the majors. It looks like they're just this kind of an open competition for the closer's role. I think that they are going to, for right now, content to seeing if any of those guys, specifically Law, Lopez, and Ferrer, can kind of capture that closer's role in spring training. But the hard part, though, is that, you know, before games start, and I heard you mentioned that games don't actually start until Saturday, but, like, it's not like watching, you know, infielders take ground balls where you can see, oh, you know, C.J. Abrams is taking the majority of the ground balls at shortstop. He's going to be the starting shortstop. You can't really tell who's going to be, you know, who has the advantage for a relief role until they pitch in a game situation, until right. That situation presents itself. And then we'll see who Davey Martinez trots out there when that first time comes. So it's going to take a while to see who has an edge. It's going to take a while for them to kind of evaluate those guys in those situations, and then they might have to make a move. Kyle Finnegan still is available. There are some other veterans out there who are still waiting for contracts. But it is kind of one of those things where the longer they wait, you know, the more they're going to have to ramp up and probably not be ready for opening day. So at this point, the Nationals are hoping that one of the guys they have in-house is going to kind of step up and be the guy that they're going to count on to close games. It also might be by committee. You know, I mean, Jose Ferrer is a lefty. Poche's a lefty. The other guys are righty. So it might be just based on matchups to closing instead of one standard closer like they have with Kyle Finnegan in the past couple of years.
All right. Let's talk about the rest of the team. What are the chances that they will hit with much more power in 2025 than they did in 2024?
I think the chances are pretty good. I mean, I think that's partly because they really can only go up. They were one of the worst, if not the worst, teams in hitting home runs last year. They brought in Josh Bell, who we've seen be a pretty big power bat, and now that he's pretty much going to be the everyday designated hitter, he doesn't have to worry about, you know, playing first base anymore. He can focus solely on hitting. And, you know, when we talked to him when he signed back in January – You know, he mentioned that, you know, he's got to get back to getting his slugging up, his OPS up, and the home run powers. He can't just be looking to, you know, hitting for average anymore. He really needs to get the ball in the air and try to get back to being a power hitter. So hopefully that comes to fruition. Nathaniel Lowe, more of an on-base guy than a power hitter, but he does have 20 home run power potential. And Paul DeJong, although he does not hit for average very well, what you like to see from your shortstop, third baseman, infielder, he hit 26 home runs last year, and that would have led the Nationals because only one player hit 20 homers for this team last year, and that was TJ. So I think there's a good chance that the guys that they brought in, and plus you're also looking at guys like James Wood, Dylan Cruz having full seasons. You know, hopefully James hits 20-plus homers. Dylan gets around 15 to 20. I think those guys can also help with their power. Kaber Ruiz needs to have a huge season, really needs to turn around his season this year and hit for more power as well. So I think that there's a good chance that the offense hits for more power, hits more home runs. But that, again, I think that also kind of goes back to they really only have only up to go because they hit so few last year.
Is the outfield the strength of this team?
Yeah, it's one of them for sure. I mean, I think looking across the board, I mean, Davey came out and said, day one and pretty much said their starting outfield is James in left, Jacob Young, who was a Gold Glove finalist in center, and Dylan Cruz in right. So, you know, at least defensively, you know that's going to be a very good outfield. There's not going to be a lot of guys hitting the balls over their heads. Not a lot of shallow balls are going to fall in for blue base hits. Those guys are fast. They have strong arms. They're going to be very good defensively out there. And then offensively, you're talking about Cruz and Wood hanging at top of the lineup and, you know, Jacob Young with the ability to steal 20, 30 bases if he gets on base. And if he can provide any sort of offense for them, that will be a bonus because he brings such excellent defense in center. So, yeah, I do think the outfield is definitely one of, if not the strongest pieces of this roster because of you've got the potential, all-star potential in Cruz and Wood. And then you also have the defensive, high defensive caliber of Young in center.
Just quantify, if you will, Bobby, just give me the kind of year that you think we'd sit back at the end of it and say, really good years for Cruz and Wood. What would it look like?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a while now. You know, as we've gotten to spring training, of course, we want to see them start playing some games too. But, you know, for Wood, I think, like I said just a little bit ago, 20-plus home runs, you know, getting up near 100 RBIs, the OPS looks really good, you know, 850 plus. You know, the strikeouts might still be there, but as long as he's driving the ball when he makes contact, I think that's a good sign for him. You know, maybe even around 20, if not more, stolen bases. I think he can be one of, if not the leader offensively, statistic-wise, on this team. You know, I know he's still got some growing to do. He only played for, the last 3 months of the season last year, so might still need some more adjustments to major league pitching, a full major league season, but he's got all the talent in the world. So that could be kind of his season as a sophomore follow-up. And then for Cruz, he's still technically a rookie. I think he has the 20 homer potential in him. I'm not expecting that this year, his first full season, I would say around 15, but you know, hopefully he walks more. Hopefully he doesn't strike out as much as he did last year when he was slumping. Hopefully he plays excellent defense. And I'm looking for him to, when he does get on base, steal 20 bags, kind of him and Jacob Young, CJ, getting if all four of those guys can get 20-plus on the bases, that really would help this team because we know how aggressive they like to be, and that's a big part of their offense, especially if guys like Wood, Lowe, Bell are driving them in behind them. So I think, you know, having Dylan be in the running, if not winning Rookie of the Year this year, would be huge. I don't think that's out of the question. Maybe should be the expectation for him as the former number two overall pick, number one prospect in all of the sport. But yeah, I think those two guys are primed, you know, given that everyone's healthy, given that everyone gets the opportunity that they're going to get to play every day. You know, they could have pretty big breakout years. Could be exciting to watch those two in the outfield and on top of this lineup.
I'm assuming CJ Abrams will be the leadoff hitter. What does it look like after that?
Yeah, I would think it would go CJ, Dylan, James. You got lefty, right there. The four hole, you know, maybe Nathaniel Lowe, Josh Bell as your cleanup hitter to add some power behind those guys if they get on base. Any combination of those two right there. you know, you would like Kaber Ruiz to be right there if his bat comes around after last year, but that I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't the case right out the gate. So maybe a Paul DeJong and then a Kaber, or you could even put Luis Garcia Jr. right there. And we haven't talked too much about him, but don't forget he had a fantastic year last season.
Did he lead the team in home runs?
I think
when
CJ
all was said and done,
did. I think CJ technically did, but Louis was right there and also stole 20 bags. And played really good defense at second. So looking for another good year from Louis, he could be your, you know, five or six hitter. And then K-Bear, Paul DeJong, and then you're looking at probably Jacob Young kind of resetting the table as your nine hitter in center field. So, yeah, I think Davey could have some fun with this lineup, especially if those young guys on top of, at the top of the order get on base. It all starts with them. It all starts with them getting on base, stealing bags, putting pressure on opposing pitchers. And then those new guys you brought in, they really need to be able to drive the ball and drive in runs.
So lastly, and we can circle back before the opener and we can get your win total projection. But
right.
This division, I mean, with Soto now in New York, with obviously Philadelphia and Atlanta, I mean, what's really the best case for the Nats? Like, if they put everything together, if everybody stayed healthy, if everybody outperformed where they are, I mean, still, how much distance is there between the Nats and the Powers in the NL East?
Yeah, I still think it's pretty decent because, you know, we talked about adding this offseason and, you know, all three of those teams added and have top 10 payrolls in the majors. I think the Mets and Phillies are top five and the Braves are right behind them. So, you know, those teams are built to compete in October. They are built to go win a championship right now. And clearly the Nationals aren't there yet, and that's okay. But I do think, you know, with the way that the schedule has changed, they don't play them as often as they used to. So you're only playing those three teams 13 times each instead of 19 times each.
Right.
They beat up on the Marlins again, and then you play other teams across the league. You know, I think that part has been fun for me, especially when in terms of evaluating, because before the schedule changed, it was tough to evaluate the rebuild because they were playing so often against these division teams that we know are better than them.
Right.
And now they're playing against other teams that are similar or in similar processes of the rebuild, or, you know, kind of like the Royals are young and up and coming, the Orioles young and up and coming. So you're kind of getting to see them play more often against other teams that are in similar situations and see how they match up with them. But I do think that, you know, this division is tough. It's going to be one of the toughest in baseball. It's not easy to win in this division no matter who you are. But I think the way that the schedule is set up where you play everybody and you don't play those guys as often, I think they can inch closer to 500. I think that, I mean, but again, like you said, everyone has to be healthy. Cruz and Wood have to lead the way. The pitching staff has to be better or take another step at least. And they probably do need to find a or maybe the closer by committee works, but they do need to find maybe the lockdown guy by opening day, excuse me. So, I think this team has potential to be around, if not slightly above 500. But now they got to go out and show it. I mean, Davey Martinez said day one to his team on full squad workouts that, you know, they're here. They're no longer the team that's up and coming. They're here. They're here to win this season. They're not looking to evaluate anymore. They're not waiting for the young group of core guys to come up. They're all there right now. So they're looking to win this year, not just develop.
Bobby, thanks. Really appreciate it. As always, hope to catch up with you, excuse me, before the season starts.
Yeah, thanks. Anytime, Kevin. Really appreciate the time.
Bobby Blanco, everybody, from Masson, at Bobby_Blanco. The Nats over-under is around 71.5. But here's one thing to consider. Atlanta, Philadelphia, and the Mets are all they're pretty close in odds to win the division. But beyond that, they are 2, 3, and 4, put them in any order you want, in odds to win the NL pennant. The Dodgers are a heavy favorite to win the National League pennant and return to the World Series and defend their World Series title. But the three at the top of the NL East are the next three odds-wise behind the Dodgers. It doesn't come from other divisions, so they are in a loaded division this year. But they open up Saturday spring training, and we're just over a month away from opening day. All right, when we come back, there is a story out there that says there's a Philadelphia Eagle free agent who Washington may target. I'll tell you who that is when we return. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.
Coming up a bit later on the Junks, actually in about 25 minutes, Nick Dowd from your Washington Capitals. He'll join us at 8:25. And Tony Skin, head coach of the George Mason Patriots Hoops program, he'll be in studio with us at 9 a.m. So lots of guests upcoming. I believe joining us right now on the Rude Guest Hotline, Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. It's Tom Lavero, Washington Times columnist. I'm 99.8% sure he's calling us from some oceanfront spot in Florida. I hope I'm correct with that, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing okay, boys. I'm calling you from the Lavero Southern Compound, Winter Compound, here in Miramar Beach, Florida, home of Jack Del Rio.
So where is that? Good. What is that near?
That's in the Panhandle, about an hour east of Pensacola.
Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha.
So is this a permanent Lavero compound? Is this a rental? Can you give us some skinny on that?
No, it's just a rental, but every January and February for the past 5 or 6 years, I head south.
Mm-hmm. You're a snowbird. Very good.
Well, that's smart. It sucks up here.
So Barry Sveluga wrote a nice column about the Learners and how they're not for sale anymore. And I guess the essence is you kind of, at the end of the day, have a bone to pick with sort of the idea that they're still like going to even be competitive at all, that they're not spending money, they have an ownership issue, and... Is your contention, Tom, that they're definitely still for sale because they're not spending money, or that they got an ownership problem?
Well, they have an ownership problem. I don't think they're on the market for sale, but I think if somebody came along with the right price, they would be. But, you know, try to buy a box of Paperclip from the Learners. It's a difficult test to buy anything from them. So it's always going to be a difficult process. So I don't think they're for sale right now. And surprisingly, when they were for sale, there weren't any names that surfaced except for Ted Leonsis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I don't understand why that is, and that still remains the case. So I don't think they're for sale anymore. My issue is the ownership, particularly this facade that they put up, that they're willing to put up the money. All Mike Rizzo has to do is ask. That's a joke.
Yeah, I saw this on Twitter yesterday, and you can fill us in. The Christian Walker story, that Rizzo was about to sign him and then called Lerner. What's the story there?
Well, you know, Mark Lerner has pledged in a 2023 interview with Dan Coco that anytime Mike needs a resource, all he's got to do is ask. Well, according to my sources, that when it came time to give Walker a 3-year deal for $60 million, that the Learners balked.
Mm-hmm.
They said no. They didn't want to go the years.
So they wanted to go maybe 1 year or two, but not three.
Yeah, 3 years.
3 years.
I mean, $60 million, that over 3 years, $20 million a year, that is not
that's nothing.
A mega signing.
Right.
Do they have, I don't even know, when I think about it off the top of my head, now that they've kind of gotten rid of Corbin and these other guys, who's their highest salary guy?
It's Lowe.
Which is?
I'm guessing, Tom, you might know better than me, but I think Nate Lowe, who they signed from the Rangers.
What's he making?
I think he's their highest ranking or highest salary per year.
Yeah, I think on the active roster.
Yeah.
They're still carrying Strauss.
Right.
And they're still paying deferred payments on Scherzer and all that. But every team as that kind of situation. Yeah. I mean, they have a roster that as of last week had a $60 million payroll.
Lowe's at $10.3 million.
There you go.
Looks like his number. So Walker would have been by far their highest paid guy, like double.
Yes.
The next closest guy, and they drew the line on that.
Yeah. The front office was looking to add 60 home runs to this lineup this year between, you know, DH and first base. And, you know, Walker was a guy who in the past 2 years hit almost 60 home runs.
Right.
In the past 2 years. Now, Nate Lowe was a great trade by Rizzo. He's a good first baseman. He has some pop, but he's not Christian Walker. He's not what they originally wanted.
So, Tom, if you're a Nats fan heading into the season, how do you deal with the fact that just in your own division, you've got the Mets with the biggest payroll in the league, you've got the Phillies with the top four payroll, and you have a Braves team that has a top 10 payroll? And the Nats are way behind them.
They can't compete.
When it comes to spending. Like, if you're a Nats fan, you're basically just, you're going to Nats Park for entertainment, obviously, and to watch baseball, but you don't have a realistic shot at competing in the division, right?
No. Now, look, they have a lot of good young players. There's reason to be excited about that. But, the front office wanted last year and this year to add some veterans mixed in with those young kids because of and veterans who will be here more than 1 year.
Right.
Because a veteran presence in the clubhouse is important for the development of these young players. Maybe if they had a veteran presence who was there for more than a cup of coffee last year, your star all-star shortstop isn't in a casino at 8 in the morning on a day game in Chicago gambling.
So these teams that have gone this route before where they've kind of bottomed out, they're loaded up on prospects, the Astros come to mind, I don't know. I'm sure you can name a few other instances. Could the learners argue that they don't really have to, like, gradually get better? They just have to wait for the young guys to be ready, and then the wins will come like almost like right away. Like, you don't have to gradually get there.
But that ignores the player development part. Part of their player development plan is to, like I said, to surround all these young players with a couple of veterans. Mm-hmm. Look, baseball, I think more than any other sport, the clubhouse has a big influence on how the team runs. Okay. I mean, the managers and the coaches certainly have a strong influence, but inside the clubhouse, there's a lot of business conducted. And that, you know, the front office felt that it was important to mix in with these young players, you know, some veterans as part of that development. Plus, they wanted these kids playing meaningful games in September. You know, let's say they're 5 games out of a wild card in September. I mean, then you're playing meaningful games. That is part of player development too, is to show them what it means to be playing in pennant race Major League Baseball games. Here's the other thing. We know with the family, with the owners, that the clock is ticking on all these young players the minute they get to the major leagues. Yeah. You have a window of opportunity. You know, it may be 6 years, but, you know, James Woods, it's now 1 year closer to free agency. You know, Dylan Cruz, 1 year closer to free agency. We know that because they just don't sign their players to long-term contracts. So there's a window of opportunity with these young players, and to waste it on, you know, continued, you know, frugality, I think is foolish.
I mean, after they win the World Series, I'll toss 2020 out, all right, the COVID year, because they only played 60 games, and made some trades.
Right.
But 21 through 24. So those 4 seasons, they've only improved by 6 wins. So Eric's talking about gradually getting better. Okay, I guess technically you're gradually getting better.
1.5 wins per season.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting they are gradually getting better.
No, I understand what you're saying. I'm agreeing with you. Because they're not, I don't think they are gradually getting better. Now, they did bring up some of these younger guys like Cruz and Wood.
Seems like they've already written off this year.
You say they wanted to add a couple of big bat veterans. Lowe and Bell just aren't those guys. I mean, they're going to combine for maybe 35 or 40 homers, not 60. So
right.
I think fans are just very frustrated that they're not getting better quicker, because it's been basically a 5-year rebuild, and it looks like, based on what they added, it's going to be a 6-year rebuild, and who knows after that.
Yeah. Again, I think it's frustrating. It should the big takeaway should be for me is that the front office wanted to build a team that the owners wouldn't let them build.
Yeah.
And that's never good.
And you have that confirmed, the Walker story. That's locked. That's a fact.
Yes, I do. Now, I mean, you know, is anyone from the Nationals going to come forward and say, yes, that's true? No.
Yeah.
But it's been out there for 2 days, and nobody from the team has refuted it.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Tom Lavero about the state of the Nationals, one of the other things that has been happening, and I wonder how the Nationals feel about this and the ownership's how the owners feel about it is the attendance has gone down. You know, now when they were winning, you had, you know, attendance, average attendance, 31,000, 32,000, that sort of thing. It's dwindled to 24,000. And I got to believe it's going to be even lower this year based on the lack of activity in the offseason.
You know, I'm surprised it's as high as it's been. I give credit to the fans. They're still showing up. I thought it would even be lower. You know, the according to my sources, the learners claim they're losing $100 million a year. Mm-hmm. On this team. I find that difficult to believe. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that's their claim. Look, I know that they're in the real estate business, commercial real estate business, and that's a real tough business to be in right now. I mean, that's been crashing and continues to crash. And
yeah, it has been for 5 years.
But didn't you say that their net worth somehow has still gone up significantly?
I didn't say that. No. I don't know if it did or not.
Okay.
My point is they're still in the baseball business. If you're going to own a team, operate it like a baseball team. You know, not like a vacant office building in the district.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tom, in your article, you point out that there's a rift between Mark Lerner, who wants to hang on to the team, and then other family members who want to sell the team. Do you have any more insight on that? Is it just him against three or four other members of the family that want to sell and he doesn't? He's just the lone holdout?
It's not like a bad blood rift, but mm-hmm. there is a disagreement. Mm-hmm. Mark does not want to sell the team. I think the two brothers-in-laws would sell the team, and I think Mark's sister, as I understand it, you know, are siding with Mark at this point. Again, I think if somebody came along with the right price, that could change, but no one seems to be willing to do that. And the right price for the learners is probably far more than what they would actually sell for.
So if the price was, if the certain price that Mark Lerner is looking for was offered, do you think he would sell it?
I think it would be hard for them not to.
Yeah. So is there any chance that, you know, because last year the Kansas City Royals were a huge surprise because they were a team that were, you know, finishing fourth, fifth in their division. And then all of a sudden, some of the young players, like the Bobby Witt Juniors of the world, just turned into superstars, and they added some other guys, and they get to the playoffs. So they had a 30-win difference from 23 to 24. Now, I know that's not going to happen with the Nats, but is there any chance that some of these younger guys can blossom a little earlier and they could be 10 wins better than last year? Any chance
of that? Yeah, there's a chance. Again, they've done a good job of developing players. They have some good young pitchers and good young position players, and there's reason to be excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike Kansas City, they have to play the Mets, the Phillies, and the Braves.
That's true.
What, you know,
is it 14 times?
42 times.
Yeah.
Over the course of a season.
Right.
You know, the Royals aren't doing that.
That's true.
So that's the big difference right there. Look, again, there will be a lot to be interested and excited about, but I think if you're a fan, you're getting shortchanged by your owners.
Well, I think they just don't want that in between, and I don't know that it's possible, but it sounds like they're not interested in winning 74 games. Like, they'd rather just win 65 and then wait until their young players are more ready and then go all in. So they've already decided they're not going to win anything this year.
Get better draft picks.
Yeah, they just already decided they're not going to be good enough this year, so I'm not going to waste any money. And, you know, that it probably is unfair to the fans. Right? I mean, that's kind of how I see what their perception.
But that's not what the front office wants to do. So then,
of course.
I mean, when you have a difference between the ownership and the front office, that's never a good situation for any team that you follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tommy, well, thanks as always for the time. Thanks for checking in from the Lavero Southern Compound. You're winning at life because the high in Miramar today, 70 degrees. The high here in D.C., 31 degrees. So yeah, advantage, Tom Lavero.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, boys.
Yep.
All right, buddy.
That's Tom Lavero, Washington Times columnist. Don't forget, coming up later on the show, Nick Dowd will join us at 8:25 from the Washington Capitals. And Tony Skin, head coach at George Mason. He'll be in studio with us at 9 a.m.
All right, let's go to the Rood guest hotline. Rood, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV, because Barry Sferluga of the Washington Post is waiting for us. And we wanted to talk to him about his exclusive conversation with Mark Lerner that he wrote about in the Post. So, Barry, thanks for a few minutes. So let's just start with kind of how long the conversation was and what kind of ground you got to cover.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you it was a, you know, 60 minute long, winding, everything covered interview, because it wasn't. There's, you know, a lot of negotiation just to get him to agree to talk, which he really hadn't done publicly, except for brief remarks to our Andrew Golden from the Post last year, saying they were taking the team off the market. And even when I broke the story in April 2022 that they were going to put the team on the market, those exchanges were by email. He didn't answer questions verbally. He really has not faced questions from a reporter in years, literally. So he did agree to do this. We had a pleasant chat. It was 10, 12 minutes long. And then, you know, we chatted about other stuff, stuff going on in D.C., whatever, that doesn't matter to this conversation. But, you know, he's a pleasant person. He's always been a very nice man. But, he's that family has spent the entirety of their now 19 years in a very public position, owning a company that people care about in ways that they don't care about a mall or an office building, not really being very forward-facing people. That's just their nature. But I think it was important to at least have him say, you know, here's why we changed our thinking on selling the team, and here's what we envision going forward, even if those answers don't, you know, provide 100% clarity that a lot of people would like.
So, Barry, that's one of the two huge takeaway conversation pieces I want to have with you. But let's do the first one first that you just referenced. We just wanted to see what was out there. I thought that was an amazing quote that he had. I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but when the team was for sale, bids were coming in, and then they went off the market, it was he just wanted to see what was out there. I don't know that that's how just want to see what was out there looks to me. But anyway, your thoughts on that?
The translation there is we didn't get our price.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's as simple as that. And he's not going to say that, and he doesn't have to say that. But if they were going to be blown out of the water by an offer, they would have accepted that offer. I'll go to my grave believing that. I think they still have a price in mind. If somebody came in tomorrow and offered them that price plus $1, I think the team would be back on the market. That's just not the way things unfolded. And they did say at the beginning of the process that, look, this doesn't mean we're going to completely sell the team 100%. Maybe we could find people who would inject some cash in but not have any influence, more minority partners. You could try to do that. I've never understood the reasons other than ego. Somebody would want to be a minority partner in a sports team because you have the right to put in money that and have no decision-making power. That doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me. So maybe they were looking for that kind of thing. Sure, that's fine. But that didn't happen. None of that happened. And here we are with, I mean, another reason to get him to try to talk or try to get him to talk is, you know, you go through this kind of public, not fiasco, but public process, and end up in the same place that you started off. It's fair to wonder, well, if you weren't 100% in to the point where you were going to sell or sell off pieces or whatever, it's fair to question, are you 100% in now that you've gotten to the other side of this? And there's been, frankly, you know, more losing than any team in baseball in the last 5 years, and flagging attendance and flagging enthusiasm about the team from the fan base.
And the inability to spend real money, which I want to get into. Barry Svrluga of the Washington Post is with us on Grant and Danny. So I know you asked that question. I want to give you some insight, give us some insight on that. What is the explanation for an offseason where, you know, people will point out, well, here's X amount of millions of dollars they spent. No, Corbin came off the books, and they basically dollar for dollar replaced that with a couple million extra dollars maybe added to payroll. They essentially did not add after a year of Cruz graduating and Wood graduating and being closer and theoretically turning the corner in the rebuild. They had an offseason where they could have gone out and been aggressive, and they were the opposite of that. What is the explanation for that?
It's not one that's particularly satisfying on a couple levels, I would say. One, when I ask that, like, you've spent on payroll, you've spent on big contracts in the past. Max Scherzer, $210 million. Jason Worth, $126 million. Patrick Corbin, $160 million. Extensions for Strasburg and Zimmerman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Would you do that in the future? And he said, if Mike Rizzo and the baseball operations department came to us and said, we think that this would be a good move, we would talk about it. That is not, we would do it. So I put in this piece that these words are going to be parsed, and they're going to be parsed because there are so few of them from him, not just in this piece, because there's plenty in the piece, but so few of them over time, year over year, you just don't have a lot of glimpses into their thinking. I mean, I was thinking about this in particular. I was working on trying to get Mark Lerner as I was sitting down in Ashburn for Josh Harris's season-ending press conference. Ted Leonsis does nothing but, you know, get on the airwaves and talk about his teams. So it's a very, very, very different approach. So back to the contracts, like he said, we would listen, we would talk about whether it was the right thing for a big contract, a Worth type contract. That's different than saying we would do it. And then secondly, you know, he alluded to the Jason Worth contract, which was the first big free agent signing in 2011. Your good buddy, Jason Worth. I know you guys like to hang out together.
We're pals now.
That's a great zing, Barry.
We're pals now.
He said, you know, the timing was perfect there. He's the guy that got us over the hump. Well, if you look at it, like, this is exactly the time when they signed Worth. It's an analogous time. It's not a year from now. They signed him coming off of a couple of hundred lost seasons, and then they went 80-81 and then won the division in 2012. Like, this was the time, and they did not do that. And I don't have a better answer as to why. And, you know, this, it's a kind of revelatory about the interview. It wasn't one of those ones where I felt like I had infinite time to follow up and drill down and grill and all that kind of stuff. It was going to be like, bing, 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 get in and get out. And so I don't have a really satisfying answer as to why did that not happen this season, because this season is analogous to the Worth season signing.
Barry Svrluga with us here on GND. And it sounds like I'm shooting the messenger here, Barry. You're delivering it. And your point is, of course, correct. It's the big disconnect. That's why so many fans, myself included, are just pulling their hair out and screaming. You look at the parallels. This team is better than that team. The team that just finished playing in 2024, more war, one positive war in that 2010 pitching staff. Levon Hernandez is 110 years old. Half the team's offensive war was Ryan Zimmerman. You look at this group now, more everywhere, more young players, a better core. This was the time. Do you really think that this was a baseball decision or something else? And if it's something else, obviously part of a much larger conversation.
Well, I mean, I think it's not a baseball decision. And that's not to say, Danny, that, okay, so you take Soto out of the equation because they weren't going to spend $765 million. And I think you can defend that, even though I'm an enormous, you know, Juan Soto, beat the drum for Juan Soto. But I think you can pick apart, like, why did Pete Alonso not get more than 2 years from the Mets? Like, Alex Bregman, it took a long time to get the deal he got from Boston. Like, if you go around and look at the offensive free agents, you can pick holes and say those weren't the guys that are going to be difference makers for us in 6 or 7 years. I know that they wanted to go after Christian Walker and they were prevented from doing that. You can also argue, is he really a game changer as an aging first baseman? Excellent defensively, can hit for power, but maybe you could argue that Nathaniel Lowe is a okay version of what you would have gotten out of an aging Christian Walker. So you can parse the baseball stuff. But I think the answer to your question is, if there had been somebody on the market that Mike Rizzo and his staff said, this is the one, my sense is the answer would have been, we're not doing it now. And again, we did not address this very specific thing in our interview, but my strong sense from around the organization is what I would consider to be a little bit backwards thinking, that we need more people to buy tickets so that we have revenue coming in to pay players, I think is backwards from we need to pay players so that people have reason to buy tickets. That's how I would phrase it. And then, you know, further complicating all of this is, of course, Masson, the 20-year shadow over the entire operation. They're not getting the money from the Orioles right now for the latest 5-year installment of Masson TV rights. That's a legitimate hindrance. Like, if they don't get that money, that's $320 million from 2022 to 26 that they could turn into, you know, mid-level free agents or whatever they wanted to turn it into. I would give them the right to say, and they can't, Mark couldn't talk about this because it is in the courts, but like, that is pretty legitimate that they're getting right now zero in that revenue stream when they should be getting, you know, an average of about, I guess it would be $60 or $70 million a year.
That's well said. Barry Svrluga's with us on G&D. So I guess I have a two-parter. One of them is just a reaction to what you were just saying, or at least a rebuttal, and I'm kind of arguing with someone who's not here who you're explaining the thoughts of. But you would think that they would get the if you build it, they will come thing, right? Like, in that they've had 6 years where their attendance was well over 30,000 a game, and they were the 2013 to 2019 years. It was when the team was good at baseball. And I don't think it's like that much of a, you know, a science experiment to figure out that when you're winning 94 games, more people are coming to your ballpark. So I guess that's thought number one. But then the second thing is, I went into this offseason thinking, if they don't spend a little bit, I'm going to assume that this group's not going to spend again. And they didn't. And that's kind of now my assumption. Am I wrong for thinking that way?
I think you're not wrong. I think we don't know. And I think I would say just a couple things. One about attendance. Like, if you look at attendance highs are generally not the year in which the team is successful. It's the following year because you get excitement about, hey, we just won the division title and I'm thinking about a partial season ticket plan and maybe my buddies and I will go in on one and I'll do 20 games a year or whatever it is. So that's why 2013, which it was a disappointing year, that was the World Series or bust, Davey Johnson's second year. You know, it didn't work out. They did not win the division title, coming off the 2012 season when they broke through and Bryce was a rookie and all of that stuff.
Still their highest attended per game rate ever was that 2013 season.
2005. The inaugural season.
Yeah, that's true. Nats Park is what I'm talking about, but that's
correct,
true.
Correct, for sure. So you're right about that. Like, they should draw some lessons from attendances in the past. I also would say the unknowable here, and again, showing the limitations of my conversation with Mark, and I'm not sure whether he would even address this, but all of that stuff is pre-COVID, and all of that stuff is pre-COVID really laid waste to a lot of commercial real estate companies and really had a huge impact on businesses that have a large stake in, like, office buildings and things like that, and that is Lerner Enterprises. Now, they're diversified. I don't profess to be an expert on their business. But the question is a long-winded way of saying, like, did the impact of the pandemic have such a profound impact on your business that that is in turn having an impact on how you run your side business, which is the Nationals. Steve Cohen in New York, it is a bad example because you don't expect, you know, we don't have to expect the Learners to spend $370 million on payroll. But he is very clear that, look, I made all my money in this hedge fund stuff. That is my primary business. This is my side business. I can spend money, my own personal money, on this business, on the baseball team, because I want to, and I want to be kind of a hero to Mets fans. That's a very different take than the Learners have on their team. And I just always wonder how, what's the relationship between the core business that the Learner family, you know, grew up with, that Ted Learner made them billionaires, and their running of the baseball team.
Barry, let me sneak one in super quick. We're up against it, but I want to know this one. If they were in the bidding for certain guys, and then they said, you know what, that's probably too rich for our blood to overpay for Anthony Santander, or, you know, name that player, I think I'd feel a lot better about it. The fact that they weren't linked to anybody, I think, is the part that I find most distressing. Your reaction?
Yeah, I think that's fair, Danny. I also think there's a reality, and if you go back to the Worth example, because I think it's so analogous, like, they're in a position right now where they have to overpay to break any sort of tie, because they're on an island, they're young, and if you believe in them, up and coming, but that might not be really easily seen from the outside. So they're not going to beat the Red Sox on an equal offer for Alex Bregman. They're not going to beat the Blue Jays on an equal offer for Anthony Santander. It's a hard position to be in until they show the rest of the sport that, oh my, your good core is really, really good, and I want to be a part of that, kind of in the way the Commanders are. They're going to have to overpay to break all those ties.
Which makes sense. I don't need Alex Bregman. Christian Walker would be nice, right? I'd just like to walk before I could run. But it's a great piece, and really just getting to talk to Mark Lerner is an accomplishment. So well done. Darius Feluga of The Post here on Grant and Danny. Thanks for the time. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, guys. Anytime.
Yeah, go check it out in The Post. It's a worthwhile story on the Nats and Lerner.